Welcome to the Private Investment Podcast brought to you by Limited Partners Club. We bring together private sector investors to tackle subjects like wealth creation, capital preservation, and legacy. We hope you enjoy.
And I'm excited for this call today. So our topic for today is about high-level understanding the different sub-asset classes in the commercial real estate sector. So we're going to go through sort of the large food groups and kind of talk about the nuances and some of the demand drivers and what sort of segments within each asset class, and then kind of talk high level as far as what considerations should be made when choosing to allocate or invest in a specific asset type. So let's dive right into it. Some of the topics that we're going to be covering, and these are a lot, most would break this down into a smaller list. If you're looking at the screen, you know, we've kind of broadened the list a little bit. And then within each of these sub-asset classes, there's many different types and sectors and different different property types within that specific class. So we're going to do an overview of office, industrial, multifamily, retail, self-storage, senior housing, and hospitality. So there's a lot of ground to cover, but we're going to keep it high level and sort of talk about the overall asset class. And again, each of these, and we'll talk about it further, each of these can be broken down, further segmented into sort of property type. We're not going to get into that today. We're going to talk high level overview and the demand drivers and some considerations. So starting with office, office is, as you know, comes in many different shapes and sizes. Think about downtown San Francisco, then think about your sort of suburban neighborhood. You got smaller single story medical buildings or unique office spaces once again, medicals. So to break this down, office is really sort of segmented into three main parts, and starting with the size. The size, there's either high rise, which is above seven stories, mid rise, which is typically seven stories. I've got this flipped. High rise is above 25 stories. Mid rise is 7 to 25, and low rise is typically below seven. So size is obviously an important factor, but moving on to the location is sort of what would make a development high rise, mid rise, or low rise. So there's two types of locations when it comes to looking at office space, and it's usually determined by, is it a CBD market or a central business district, or is it a suburban market, which would be outside of that downtown area? When we think of big office space or high-rise buildings, they're all typically 99% of them are in a CBD market. These would be Manhattan, San Francisco, downtown LA, downtown Phoenix. These are CBD markets, and that's where you'll see high-rise and mid-rise buildings. Once you go out to the outskirts of those CBD markets into suburban areas, I'm in Phoenix. So if you were in Chandler, for example, or Scottsdale, you're not going to see very many high rises. You might see one, a very few, one or two or three in different markets, but typically they're going to be low rise or mid rise, usually under seven stories. And again, it's because of the land restriction in that area. And so when you move into suburban areas, land is less restrictive. It's cheaper. It's cheaper to build. There's less of a barrier to entry. And so when you move, building a high rise costs more money than building one story. And so when land is cheaper and less restrictive, developers can develop horizontally rather than vertically in suburban locations. And lastly, office is is broken down into usage. So there's, when you look at CBD markets, the typical tenants are professional services, finance industry. So you'll see, you know, big banks, JP Morgan's, who have big high-rise office space in a lot of CBD markets, these types of professional and finance industry. And then you have medical, and medical could be, it's usually in the outskirts, in the suburban areas. This could be your dentist's office or small practices. And these are just to back up for a second, these different usage types sort of demand a certain type of tenant. When you are developing a high rise, you're usually the development, the interiors consist of cubicles, lounges, individual office spaces, and they're sort of like a shell. And it works for a lot of tenants that use those types of buildings because they can come in and refresh the interior, organize the cubicles how they want, or remove them and build an open space concept. So there's not very many tenant improvements typically that go into those types of buildings. Now, medical, whereas it's usually a mid-rise or usually a low-rise building, you know, 1 to 2 stories typically, there is more heavy lifting with the tenant improvements. Think of a dental office where they have rooms and they have different flooring and ways to keep the building sanitary. And so when that tenant changes or turns over to a potentially different type of industry, there's a lot more heavy lifting that needs to go into the tenant improvements. And tenant improvements, again, are the improvements, the physical improvements that need to be made in order to cater to that tenant. So usually there's a credit a lease back if there's more cost, where the developer or the building owner will actually pay up front for some of those improvements and then work out a credit with that specific tenant. And lastly is flex space. And flex space is where there might be a business running in there, people work in there in an office-like setting with a receptionist or desks or offices, but part of the building might be used for sort of more industrial space. They might be running, they might be shipping out product, for example. And so there might be bays or roll-up doors where tractor trailers delivery vehicles can use that part of the building to ship product. And so flex space, I believe it's 75% of the building must be used for industrial purposes. And that last portion needs to be there for office. I'm not sure if that's the exact number, I might have it mixed up, but part of the building has to be reserved for office in order for it to qualify for office space. But some of it can be used for shipping and more warehouse type of usage. And this is kind of the high level of office. So you got location, usage, and the size. And all of the sub-asset classes that we're going to be talking about today, including office, are usually perceived by an investor or the market by asset class. And we're not going to get into that today, but high level, all real estate is typically graded depending more or less depending on the specific sub-asset type. But one sort of factor is by looking at the grade of the property or the class. So class A, class B, class C, class D. Class A is new, nice amenities, good locations, good neighborhoods. And on the opposite side of the spectrum, D is pretty much the worst that you can think of. Rundown neighborhoods, needs capital expense. It's not in a great neighborhood, and so on and so forth, and everything in between there. So all of these sub asset classes are sort of used with this grading system, like we're back in high school, from A to D, and D is pretty much failing. So some of the demand drivers for office space, it really, office, if you think about it, is really about employment. So when employment, when the job market's good, when we have low unemployment, and companies are hiring, that means up until recently with work from home, et cetera, and the pandemic, that people need office space. They need to have a place for their people to work at. And so historically, office has been driven, office demand has been driven by employment and the overall economy and hiring, and obviously geographic locations where those companies are located. And the other aspect is that specific industry. So obviously, the tech industry does good sometimes, the medical industry does good, the financial industry does good. And depending on those, the specific tenant sector, and looking at the performance in that specific industry, that's going to determine what sort of demand can be expected for a specific building that's targeted toward a specific tenant. So for example, if there is, if we're looking at, you know, high-rise buildings in Manhattan, typically a lot of these tenants are in the finance industry. When credit becomes tight and lending becomes tight and demand for capital is sort of dried up because of changes in policy, sort of like exactly what we're going through right now in the market and the economy, those types of tenants are going to be laying off people. Okay, they're going to be slowing down. There's not as much demand for growth in that sector because of the changes in economic policy. And so those are some of the demand drivers that sort of drive the performance of office. And lastly, some of the considerations that are obviously here and are sort of the elephant in the room right now, and that is, what does the future of office look like? Will there be demand for office as much as there was several years ago or a decade ago? In my opinion, the answer is no, but there's going to be different ways that people work. People will go back to the office. People do need to go back to the office, but there's going to be different. There's going to be more flexibility for sure. We have already proven that. But the fact is that people will go back to the office. I think it's just going to look differently. So if you look back in time and look at where we are now, you can see that there's obviously market changes. We'll talk about this later a little bit, but there's market changes in how people work. So years ago, everybody wore a suit. Everybody was in the office, right? Everybody drove to work and drove home. Then there started to be more of this millennial area of open space concept and collaboration and not as much professional stigma. We got rid of suit and ties, for example, and interiors started to become more cool and sort of this like fun feeling in the office space, where certain amenities become more popular, like lounges and no more cubicles and sort of this open concept, even game rooms and stuff like that, to keep people in good spirits and want to be there at work and have this flexible work day. And so that obviously has taken us to a point where now some of the bigger office leaders in the industry are WeWork, where their properties and the feeling of their space sort of feels like a hotel. You got an open kitchen, you've got lounge area, there's no cubicles, nice interiors, quality designs, And I think we'll, you know, see that continue to develop. But I think that it's also starting to lean back more into the, okay, this is your space to work, et cetera. I'm not going to go too deep in this, but I think that we'll continually see the way that people work change. And it's by generation and technology and sort of what the market, what the new workforce desires. And we'll start to continue to see that really sort of unfold, especially this year when sort of the larger employers are debating on how to get people back in the office and what desires are there. Let's dive into industrial. Industrial is the least glamorous type of real estate, and it's become, it's always been in demand, but the demand has changed, obviously, with certain things like e-commerce, okay, and the internet, right? So the industrial footprint is changing. And there's three sort of sectors again here as it relates to industrial. It's the type, it's based on accessibility, and it's based on function. So industrial is just four walls and a roof, and it's usually just a shell. And so it's one of the cheaper buildings to develop. The land is certainly cheap as well. They're not in CBD markets. They're not in neighborhoods. They're usually in the least expensive parts of town, and even a lot of times in the middle of nowhere. And so industrial is one of our, we're definitely biased towards industrial because of the, because of all the things that we're talking about. But let's break this down. So there's three types of industrial properties. One is manufacturing, okay, or fabrication. So this is the actual building of products. For example, think of a Coca-Cola building where they're bottling Cokes, and they've got the treadmill type of things where they're shipping things out and packaging them, and they're shipping them out of that space. But they're manufacturing the products, and that takes machinery and all sorts of stuff. And then there's more warehouse, storage space, and distribution space. So these are where Amazon fulfillment centers, for example, where they're not manufacturing things there. They're storing it in a warehouse setting and distributing it out of that space. And then lastly, there's flex space, which we talked about this with office, but it's basically a mix between industrial and a place where people can work as well. So more lounges, more office space, but also a space for warehouse and distribution, et cetera. One of the most important things about industrial is its accessibility. And so if you'll notice, when you see industrial properties, they're typically near the freeway. They're near major interstates. They might be around the airports. And the reason is because what these properties are made for is storing and shipping goods and manufacturing, storing and shipping goods. That's their main purpose. And so accessibility is a major aspect of this asset type. And so people want, there's no need for a lot of parking, but people need open spaces for semis to pull in and turn around and back up and get out of there and get on the freeway and not sit in traffic. And the closer they are to major interstates or highways or ports or rail or airports, these are the important factors of these types of buildings. And lastly is its function. So accessibility, efficiency, function, these are the main sort of fundamentals of industrial. And the function, obviously, again, it's the property is set up to do a certain type of thing. It's either, it could be a data center, it could be the fabrication of goods, or it could be just a place to store and distribute. So how, again, back to tenant improvements, like we were talking about office, there's different sort of types of properties that are geared towards a certain type of tenant. Let's talk about some of the demand drivers. Again, transportation is a big deal, right? Accessibility. And so when shipping becomes so expensive, that can hurt industrial demand, for example. The big one is that a lot of people know of is e-commerce. And retail is still a very strong asset class, and we'll get into that later. But e-commerce is really driving the growth in this sector. And we all, at least most of us, have Amazon Prime. And so the reason why Amazon Prime and other leaders like Walmart can deliver a product within 2 days or less, or the same day in some cases, is because of the footprint, the geographic footprint those companies have in their industrial space. So for example, if all the industrial buildings were only in one location and they were miles and miles and miles out of town, they wouldn't have the same ability to deliver, distribute those products in that short period of time. So we demand, the market demands immediate shipping, same day delivery, 2 day delivery. And in order to achieve that, the industrial footprint needs to be closer to where those people are, right? In CBD markets, in the neighborhoods. And so I think we'll start to see, we are already, but we'll start to see more flex space, more distribution space, not necessarily big, huge warehouses, but more smaller sort of distribution spaces within our immediate markets. And so I think, you know, the future of industrial is not necessarily big warehouses in the middle of the desert to transport goods. Those will still be in demand, but the distribution, so warehouse and distribution, in my opinion, are two different things. Distribution is where we can store a certain amount of necessary goods and deliver it to our clients as soon as possible, really the same day. And that's going to take more properties, smaller properties potentially because of the land restriction, and more flexible space. So the last sort of demand driver that we'll talk about is incentives. So a lot of if you're paying attention to sort of the big corporates that move into a certain area, for example, I'm in Phoenix. We have, everybody gets all excited. Obviously, it's good for the real estate market when big corporations come here. They bring jobs, right? Which we like. They drive demand, and it's a good sort of point to look at. If big corporates are moving to a certain location, that means others tend to follow, which is good for the economy, and that's what we like. And so the cities and the states are actually incentivizing big companies to start business in their state. And so there's tax incentives to develop big properties, for example, for them to break ground in their city. So these are some of the demand drivers for industrial. Let's talk about multifamily, which everybody loves. So multifamily, we'll keep it high level here. There's really, multifamily is definitely less complex as far as the certain types. There is definitely types, and it comes down to, there's new types as well. Everybody's heard of build to rent. So let's talk about the types of multifamily first here. You've got traditional apartments. These are your, and again, multifamily, back to our statement earlier, is one of those asset classes where people really look to the asset grade, A, B, C, and D. A lot of people like Class A, a lot of people like value add. And so this is one of the most popular asset classes, as I'm sure you know. And sort of the main A lot of demand is geared towards Class B value add, traditional apartments with room to inject capital, refurbish, release, and trade that asset. So some of the types, and I just want to pinpoint that there because a lot of investors look at grade when it comes to multifamily over, you know, certain things like location and type, et cetera. So the types, you've got traditional apartments. These are your 12-month leases. Any Jane and Joe that wants to rent, these are traditional apartments. And you've got student housing, which is usually near campuses. These are college students, and it's driven by sort of transitionary housing. They might do different types of leases there, month to month, 6 month, maybe some furnished. And then a new sort of, over the last few years, build to rent has become popular. These are in the multifamily asset class, but they're like single family properties. Just people don't have a mortgage and they don't have an HOA. They're paying rent like an apartment. They're rental property. They're just single roofs, which is becoming a very popular asset class, which we're definitely looking at in certain markets. The demand for people to have space and people starting families, this asset class will definitely do well, and it's separate from multifamily in the tenant's eyes. There's something about living in apartments. It's not everybody's cup of tea. And so for those that don't want to choose an apartment, traditional apartments, they may not want to or can't afford a home, but they want their own space. Therefore, they'll pay a slight premium to have a little yard, their own garage, and their own place to call home. And the last type, which has become less popular or more popular, I guess, but it's changing, is conversions. And so back in the earlier 2000s, condo conversions were very popular, where people, operators would buy condos and convert them to traditional apartments. That has sort of became less popular over the years because of inflated values, costs, there's some capital that it takes. And so it's become less popular, but now we'll start to see, and this goes back to our office subject of some of the big office space that could be better or repurposed to sort of be in this mixed use. So there might be some retail in the bottom, there might be some flexible workspace, there might be some actual individual office space, and there might be some apartments. And so we'll start to see more large office space in certain markets get repurposed into more mixed use and multifamily. And the last thing we'll talk about here is the size. So you got low rise or garden style apartments. These are your 2 to 4 story buildings, which are a lot in the suburban or secondary markets. Mid-rise, 5 to 9 stories, high rise, 10 plus stories. And again, it goes back to where those buildings are located. So if you go downtown or go into your central business district, you'll see high-rise buildings, and you won't see high-rise buildings in the secondary markets. Why? Because they cost more to build, and there's less land restrictions. So developers can build out rather than up. Some of the multifamily demand drivers. The big ones, population growth, obviously. So in places like Phoenix, the Sun Belt, Texas, Florida, where over the last few years, the population growth, the in-migration has skyrocketed, especially in places like Florida, Texas, and Phoenix. And so the amount of people that are moving into those markets obviously picks up demand for multifamily. One, because there may be a lack of supply in the single family or the residential space. Two, because it's transitionary, people want to rent. while they seek a place to buy, et cetera. So the amount of people in migration or population growth is one of the biggest factors for multifamily. And as we know, there is more renters. We're becoming a renter nation. And so more people will absolutely be renting. And that's where, again, sort of these new asset classes like, new sub-asset classes like build to rent will become highly in demand. Next is job growth. Obviously, again, the more jobs, the more people can get their own place and rent, et cetera. And lastly, which is a no-brainer, is the cost of ownership. So a lot of people that rent apartments can't necessarily afford a home. It's not that they choose to rent. That is a thing, but a majority of Class B and C apartments are because the cost of ownership is too high or out of reach for some people, therefore they're forced to rent. So when, just like what we saw in the last couple of years with home values exploding, which was because of the cost of capital, the cost of a mortgage was so low that assets got bid up and overvalued. But the cost of ownership at one point was very, very inexpensive. Now it's not. But before, assets were totally inflated. And when the Fed had interest rates nearly down to zero, at that point, the cost of ownership was just as much as not cheaper than renting. And so, of course, during those times, there's going to be more home buyers. And when credit becomes tight and when assets are inflated like they are today, the cost of ownership is much greater than it is to rent. Therefore, there's going to be more renters. Let's talk about retail. Retail is one that a lot of people are actually kind of fearful of. And the old ones, the ones that have been around for the years, understand that retail actually is a great performer. It'll hold strong. There's many different types of retails. They're not all malls, okay? But here's how retail is broken down. You've got traditional malls. These are your big buildings, enclosed buildings with individual stores in between. These are obviously going out of date. Just in my immediate market, there's at least two malls that I know of that have been completely shut down for years. And so we'll continue to see malls get repurposed into things like activity centers or broken down or torn down to mixed use. So we'll start to see, we'll continue to see malls get repurposed. Although some malls are still functioning and good, but so aside from malls, these are the different retail sectors. You got malls and you've got lifestyle centers. These are sort of the newer age malls. Okay. They might have, it's open concept. It's not one big building. You still have some high, maybe some luxury stores, a couple nice restaurants. It might be a drive-through. You can drive. There's a street running through it. There might be a little a cafe, a place to sit with the dogs or let your kids play. There may be a couple high-end restaurants or maybe apartments right there. And it's not about going to the mall. There might be enough demand for traffic just for a specific restaurant in there, but you also have some high-end stores and some sort of outlet type of stores there. Those are lifestyle centers. Power centers are your big box stores, and they all kind of group together. So, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but these are, if you, in most areas, when you go to a Home Depot or a Walmart, there is, whether they're connected or not, there is multiple big box stores around there. And it's about the tenant mix. So Home Depot and Walmart, for example, they need a lot of space, but they also want to be by other big box stores because the market demands visiting one location for many different needs. So not very often you're going to find a Home Depot right by itself. It might be by itself in that specific lot, not touching another store, but it's going to be right next to another big box store, your Targets or your Walmarts or your Shopcos or your Bed Bath & Beyonds. These are usually somewhat grouped together, whether connected or not. Then you've got your community centers. These are your sort of local grocery stores. You might have a couple small sandwich shops or a Starbucks nearby. These are usually anchored by a grocery, once again, and are much smaller than a power center, much smaller than a lifestyle center, much smaller than a mall. There's a few quality tenants there with an anchor tenant as well, usually a grocery store. And lastly is convenience centers. These are your 7-Elevens, your gas stations, might be, you know, a nail salon, stuff like that. And there's a small group, sort of like a strip mall, if you would, where there's a few small convenience items, services, you might have a sandwich shop. These are smaller retail sectors that are close to neighborhoods, close to where people are living and driving, et cetera. Some of the demand drivers for retail. The big one is, I'm going to jump down here if you're looking at the screen, is traffic. So retail is about traffic. Where are people living? What's the density in that area? So one of the biggest factors is how many cars are driving by this property, right? The more cars, the more eyeballs, the more people stop in, shop, spend money. So traffic count is a big demand driver. And next is consumer spending, right? So when jobs are good, when people are spending money, that's when retail thrives. So retail sales make up a huge portion of our economy's gross GDP. And so when people stop spending, like what we're seeing now a little bit, people are running up their credit cards, retail sort of gets the back end of that stick. Next is accessibility. Again, in talking about industrial, accessibility is a huge one, right? If there's always that one convenient place that you need to go and you can't turn left, you got to make a U-turn, but it's always traffic. You can't make the U-turn. So you got to do a rip around the block and sort of shortcut into this property. And that is very important. So places like Walgreens, for example, who are very strategic about where they put their properties, as well as many other brands, but accessibility to the traffic is extremely important. You don't want an odd corner where people just can't find a way in there. Although it might have heavy traffic, it's hard to actually get into the property. So accessibility is huge. And lastly, we talked about it a little bit earlier, is tenant mix. So tenant mix is, again, going back to Home Depot and Walmart, these companies, these brands want to be grouped together in an area, even if they're somewhat competitive, because people like to shop. And when people shop, they want to be able to shop at multiple locations. So a healthy tenant mix, meaning potentially the more the merrier, is better. You wouldn't want just a Shopko or a Bed Bath & Beyond by itself. Okay, people go to those areas because they're also going to Walmart or to Kmart or to Target, and they want to run in Bed Bath & Beyond as well. So a healthy tenant mix. And you always see, this is another one, think about a mattress store. So if you look up, my wife and I have joked about this in the past, but if you look up Mattress Firm, they're one of the biggest mattress providers, and there is tons of them. If you look it up in Phoenix, where I'm at, there's literally hundreds of mattress firms. And the reason is because there's been a study, and these big retailers really study their demographic in these locations, and they want to be in density. So there's this roof concept. If you look at an overview, the amount of roofs that are in the area or the density of that location, they want to strategically place themselves in the most dense locations, which have the highest traffic counts, et cetera. But the tenant mix, I lost track of what I'm saying, but the tenant mix, again, they're strategic about where they put themselves, and they want to put themselves, going back to Mattress Firm, that's where I was. But Mattress Firm knows that people like to shop, okay? And they want to shop where they can, where it is nearby. Again, they want to shop in one location, but go to multiple stores. So if there's three Mattress Firms or three mattress stores within a certain radius, chances are that they're going to shop. Even though they're buying from the same company, they're going to go and shop next door. And there's a study behind that, which is very, very interesting. Going on to the next one, self-storage, which is developed as well. And so here's the few sort of breakdowns. You've got your classic storage units. These are drive up. You drive up by car, you unroll a metal door. You've got your own personal padlock on there. There's no heating. There may not even be lights in there. It's this old, funky, very cheap property to build. You've got, it may not even be a real structure. It may be, we've all seen these old storage units where they're like literally metal boxes that are just placed on the dirt or on the concrete and have a door. So that is the classic self-storage property. And as demand for the sector has picked up, there's become definitely other types of segments within the self-storage, and that's climate control. So these climate control properties, some of the big ones, like I think CubeSmart is one of them, or that may not even be the name, U-Haul is another one. There's been demand for dry storage, not having access to potential water damage, keeping things not freezing or keeping them at cool temperatures. So these are climate controlled, and these are the types of properties that may have an actual building, an actual structure. You may have to walk in. There might be elevators or stairs. There might be a few levels, and there's heating, lighting, AC, et cetera. Specialty, these are more secure, more climate controlled. They might have more security to them. And these are where people can store wine or fine art or collectibles, stuff like that, which is similar to climate controlled, but a little more geared toward specialty items. And lastly is mixed use. So these could be anything, but I've only rented a U-Haul a few times, but when I have, a couple of those locations were a truck rental company and storage, right? Or they might have they might have boat storage, right? They might have a gas station attached to it. So those would be mixed use type of self-storage properties. The demand drivers for storage is population growth, again, just like apartments, okay? So the areas where people are moving and the population is growing, people store stuff, people keep things, okay? And where people are, there's always gonna be some demographic that has a use for storage. And so places where population is growing, storage is going to do well. Consumerism, that's another big driver, which I hate the term, but that is facts, because the more people spend, the more people buy things, especially when people can't afford houses, for example, and people are forced to rent. A time like now, for example, this is going to create demand for storage. And lastly is transition. Okay, these are places where people are moving for a job. They might be renting an apartment. They want to buy a house. And in that meantime, they don't have a garage, right? So they need to rent storage. So transitionary, for example, this could be around student housing. Okay, students may have some stuff, not necessarily as much as a family, but they're going to school, okay? And they might have roommates. So they might pay for a storage unit. That's one example. Moving on here, senior housing, which is became a big one in the last several years as well. And there's a few types of senior housing. Independent living is a place 55 plus, a place for elderly people to live, okay, by themselves. They don't need help. They just want to go into a property, not have to take care of, not have to mow the lawn anymore. They just want a nice place to live. They might have some great amenities, pickleball courts, tennis courts, swimming pools. They might even have restaurants on site, gyms, et cetera. These are independent living properties for 55 and older. And then there's assisted living. This is where this could be people need help, right? So there's people on site that are helping people, maybe with transportation to work or to the hospital or whatever it is, or to go get medication. This is a place where people are there to help them live the rest of their life. And then there is memory care or nursing homes. These are where there's actually medical people on site, full time potentially, where there's a care aspect. There's in-room nursing, hospital equipment, stuff like that. So these are the three types of senior housing. And senior housing, and we'll get into the next one and we'll talk about this later on, but this is one of these asset classes that demand heavy lifting operationally. So sort of like a hotel, which we'll get into in a moment, but there is, you don't just list the property for rent, right? There's an operation going on. There's potentially people on site. There's people transporting other people. There's a medical aspect to it. There's food and cooking and stuff like that. So it's more of this like hospitality, like feeling, but for seniors, which is operational. It's a heavy operation. Some of the demand drivers, obviously demographics, okay. When there's people aging, right. So the demographics of mostly around people aging. So where are the elderly people? Where are the seniors at? And so that comes into the geographic location. So places where it's warm, for example, where people go to retire, those are the certain markets that'll do really well in this sector. Florida is one of the biggest senior housing sectors where the most senior housing is. And so places like Florida, where it's warm, where people want to retire, those are the places where there'll be demand for senior housing. And senior housing is still sort of this, there's more attention from capital for this asset class than there ever is. And that's because of baby boomers. Baby boomers is the largest generation that we've had, and they are aging. And so, the sector will continue to grow massively over the next several decades. And so millions and millions and millions of people getting up to a certain point of age where they will need some sort of assisted living or place to call home. Okay, hospitality, moving on here, hotels. So there is a few different types of hotels. You've got the Hyatt, you've got the Days Inns, you've got all of these different types of brands. And so when you look at the sectors, you can put a brand name to it. So you've got full service hospitality hotels. They might have a bar, they have a pool, they have a gym, they might do room service, stuff like that. And you've got limited service. These are places that do, they may not have all those amenities. They may have a few, they may have a pool, a spa, but they may only do breakfast at 7 a.m., for example. And you've got budget hotels, Okay, these are they may not even do breakfast. They probably most of them do, but they may not have a pool, right? It's just like it's the Days Inns of the world, where people go there to book, stay overnight during travel, et cetera. And then you've got lastly is extended stay. These are your sort of Holiday Inns where people spend, you know, 5, 6, 7 days in a place, and they want a kitchen, right? They want access to washer and dryers. Okay, they need a park. They want their dog there. So these are the different sort of segments in hotels. And the demand is driven really by two things. It's by travel. So business travel and tourism. So you can look at, obviously, what had happened over the pandemic with travel. Travel stopped. And so travel is really, it's driven by markets for sure, geographic locations. It's driven by people's savings and job growth and employment and stuff like that. So when when the economy is good, when people have money and people are spending money, that's typically when people travel to go have trips and vacation. And then the other aspect, which has historically been one of the biggest demand drivers, is business travel. And so business travel took a huge fault, bigger than a fault than tourism did. And that's because companies have learned that there doesn't need to be as much business travel, because we can work in places like Zoom, for example, and collaborate with others online using different tools like Slack and Zoom and certain things like that. And so now there's more people working remotely. People don't necessarily get on a plane to show up at a meeting for a few hours as much as they used to because of technology. So business travel will be absolutely changed forever, but there's still a need for business travel. So these two demand drivers are certainly, you know, obvious and key to the hotel industry. Okay, that was a lot. And I'm sorry to talk my ear off. We're coming up to the end of our call here. This is one of the longest calls we've done. I'm glad that we sort of got this out of the way. It's high level. It's good to sort of recap and have an understanding of these different asset classes. Most people narrow in because it's what they know on a certain asset class. So some people are just biased towards multifamily, for example. Some people are just biased towards retail. They don't even want to think about anything else. But to understand some of the demand drivers, what's going on in these different sectors, this is what there's all these sectors. There is very good opportunities coming up. Certain sectors are going to hurt more than others, like office, but it's good to know all these things. So I'm in this call with some of the considerations. We've talked about a few, so I'll just keep it high level here. But market changes, again, we were talking about office, for example, where the shift in from the workforce of what people desire is going to continue to change, okay? So people, what once was popular 2 years ago in companies like Facebook, for example, where there's no cubicles, right? It's open lounges, it's open air, people are sharing tables. There's 30 computers on one desk. We're all working around it. I think people are going to start wanting their own space again. And so I think the breaking it up, or maybe it just is a balance between that setting and working at home. We'll see, but the market will continue in every asset class to shift based on how people want to work, how people want to live, et cetera. So when considering an investment, when considering an asset class to allocate to, these are the types of considerations we want to have on our mind. I put asset grade here because I didn't put that in any of our topics, because all assets really are sort of graded by the age, by its condition, by its location. And people use this grading system, this A through D grading system, to sort of to sort of pit the pin on that specific property. So it's Class A location, Class C property, for example, and that gives you a good idea of what we're looking at. We talked about senior housing, and another one is hospitality, obviously. And so when looking at those types of properties and looking at the overall, all these sub-asset classes, some of them are more operational focused than others. Obviously, hospitality, obviously, senior housing, these are businesses, okay? There's not a specific tenant there, and all they do is pay your rent and run their business. You are running a business, okay? There could be laundry, there could be housekeeping, there could be nursing on site, there could be prescription delivery, there could be food, right? So definitely some asset classes take more heavy lifting on the operation side than others, and that is definitely a consideration to make. Unlike properties like industrial, where there's a tenant in there for many years, and they just run their business and cut you a check, and you don't need to worry about them because they have cash balances and a long-term lease and no tenant improvements, no turnovers. That is the least heavy lifting type of property. Tenant quality. This is one that a lot of people don't think about. And okay, so one of my mentors, advisors, a great friend of mine, he does a great job at sort of putting this into perspective. And he says it like this: How well can you sleep knowing that your retirement is based on, let's just say that you invest in apartments, and that's all you invest in is Class B and C value-add apartments. Not all people pay rent, okay? And so the way to put this is, how well can you sleep knowing that the tenants in all your properties can barely afford rent in some cases, okay? Versus having a retail property or an anchor tenant or a brand name, companies, at least industrial, who have cash balances, who have creditworthy, who are big brands, and they're not going anywhere. They're running their business. Okay, they can afford the rent. So putting that into perspective, as far as the quality of tenants and when deciding to allocate to a certain asset class. It's extremely important, and this is really about risks. It's about the risk level of that property, and it goes along with your investment goals. It goes along with having multiple allocations. Okay, and of course, demand. Right, demand for these specific assets, just like what we talked about with office. Just like what we talked about with build to rent, demand is going to go up and down in each of these sectors. When the market gets cold, okay, people spend less money. Okay, that means that retail is potentially hurt. That means that the hotel sector is potentially hurt. When people get old, that means there's demand for senior housing. When people can't afford houses to buy, that means more people are renting apartments. And so the world runs in cycles. And so it is smart to have multiple allocations into each of the top asset classes, because everything goes up and down. This whole world does. And so certain sectors are going to perform better than others during certain times of the economy. And lastly is investment goals and risk tolerance. So just like what we talked about with tenant quality, that goes totally in line with the investment goals and risk tolerance, because the performance, the cash on cash return, or the potential multiple on developing an apartment building or developing an industrial building or rehabbing a Class C apartment it's gonna produce more than buying a stabilized Class A retail building. And that's because one is more risky than the other. So developing a property or rehabbing an older property, rehabbing an apartment community is gonna potentially produce a better return. But the tenant quality with the time and capital expense, it's a more potential, has more risk to it. And so all of this really depends on the investment goals and the risk tolerance. Okay, I talked enough. I hope this video brought some great insight to you and just sort of refreshed and maybe even opened up your horizon a little bit as far as what these other sub-asset classes do, what they look like, and what some of the demand drivers are. So before I let us all go and before I can have a drink of water, I want to invite you into Limited Partners Club. Okay, we are launching this quarter, officially 2023, our online community, and we'll be doing some in-person events. Our chapter, our beginning chapter, is located in Scottsdale, Arizona, where we'll be hosting some in-person events, meetup type of events, but also some private dinners. And if you are not in Phoenix, no worries, you can join us over these calls. We have these meetings regularly every Tuesday. And then we'll be doing some in-person events here in the Phoenix area, typically about once a month we're planning on, depending on how things go. And we also have, we're building out our online community. So the goal is to create a space where like-minded investors and families can come together, share insights, talk about the market, look at deals together, and really do some business together. So there's no cost to this. Our goal is not to monetize this community at all. The goal is to build a quality network of like-minded investors to share deals. And so I want to invite you in. We do require everybody to request to join, just so we don't spam the community. But go apply at limitedpartnersclub.com. That's limitedpartnersclub.com. And join us. I'd love to meet you and speak with you and invite you into the community. I'll leave it at that. Thank you so much. My name is Coburn Shepik. I'll see you next week. Cheers.